This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 30th of June, these are our main stories. Another night of arson, looting and clashes in France following the police killing of a teenage boy. The French Prime Minister says the riots are unacceptable.
We're in fact talking about some very violent individuals who are attacking our police stations. These individuals are not representative of the residents who are as shocked as us.
Pakistan gets a multi-billion dollar IMF bailout, but at a huge cost to the people there. EU leaders say they'll reduce their dependence on China, but how? Also in this podcast...
Anyone can post anything, and it has the potential to reach thousands or even millions of views, basically. Bad arguments can spread really fast.
Is TikTok failing to remove videos of people denying the existence of climate change? And we go looking for ghost particles from the Milky Way. We start in France, where President Macron has said that nothing can justify the violence that swept across the country as almost 900 people have been arrested this week. He blamed what he called professionals of violence for disrupting what should have been a period of respect after the police killing of a teenage boy on Tuesday. A third night of rioting saw many buildings, including libraries and schools, set on fire and scores of police officers injured. France's three biggest cities are suspending or restricting public transport from Friday evening. As she visited a police station, the French Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, said the government was considering all options to restore security. She also praised the police.
I really want to pay tribute to the police, the gendarmerie and the firefighters who last night were fully mobilized, both here and in other towns across France. They are dealing with violent individuals, often very young, who are attacking our police stations, mayor offices and public institutions.
The United Nations Human Rights Office says the violence that has followed this shooting in the Paris suburb of Nanterre suggests France needs to address what it calls deep issues of racism in law enforcement. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
The UN's Human Rights Office expressed concern about the killing of the 17-year-old and pointed out that the UN's Committee on Racial Discrimination had only last year highlighted worrying practices in French policing, including high numbers of identity checks and fixed fines for certain minority groups. Although the UN acknowledged that some of the protests this week had become violent, it said any use of force by the police must be proportionate, legal, and non-discriminatory. Allegations of disproportionate use of force must be investigated and those responsible held accountable.
Imogen Folks, well, in Nanterre itself, our correspondent Sophia Batitsa has been speaking to people there about Niall and the shooting, and the interviews were recorded just before last night's violence.
Justice! Justice!
Thousands of people have gathered here in Nanterre. They're marching in memory of Niall, the teenager who was shot dead by a French policeman on Tuesday. His mother, Munia, is on top of a moving van in the middle of the crowd. She says she hopes the tribute will be an opportunity for the community to remember her son, who she says was a respectful, kind boy.
It's important to be here to show support for Niall's family, to show them they're not alone.
Bakary is 18. He lives in a Paris suburb near Nanterre.
I wasn't surprised this happened, because it happened in the past and it will happen again.
Many young people attended the march. Yasmin is a 20-year-old student at Nanterre University.
It was very important to me because we are absolutely disgusted by what's just happened with Niall. He was a child, literally, he could be my little brother. It blew my mind, literally. I cannot stand and just accept that some young people who make mistakes like all of us. If we had the opportunity, we certainly take the car without having our license. He didn't deserve this at all. It's absolutely disgusting.
What do you think about the French police?
I absolutely hate them. Absolutely. I wish them the worst.
I've seen policemen beat some of my friends. I've seen them behave in a way that's unacceptable. But they know they won't get into trouble because they're the police.
Malgré peu importe ce qu'ils feront, c'est eux la police.
La police!
Yasmine and Bakary are not the only ones. There's a lot of anger at the police across France. At the march, people have been chanting "Justice for Nel" and "The police are murderers." Many are carrying signs with anti-police slogans. One of them says, "The police kills." The situation here in Nanterre is extremely tense. The march turned violent. The police clashed with protesters. There are cars burning in the street and people running from tear gas. But some people in Nanterre are furious about the riots. Nicole has lived in the neighbourhood for more than half a century.
The riots are inadmissible. They're hurting the people who live here, who can't go to work because their cars are burnt down. The rioters have been vandalising shops and they've even blocked an ambulance that was trying to get in here.
Her friend Valérie agrees. She says she hasn't been able to sleep for the past two nights.
I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. We are all scared because we don't know what's going to happen tonight. What will they do next?
The government fears that what they will do next is more violent protests, which is why they've deployed 40,000 police officers across France. Yasmine from Nanterre University again.
Do you think there will be more protests tonight, tomorrow?
I think and I hope there will be a protest until we have some answer because we need justice.
That report by Sophia Batitsa in Nanterre. The Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has welcomed a new $3 billion loan agreement with the IMF, saying it will help his country achieve economic stability. The IMF bailout lowers the risk of a sovereign debt default, as our correspondent in Islamabad, Caroline Davis, reports.
Today's announcement could not have come at a more crucial time. Pakistan has had very low amounts of foreign reserves to pay its import bill, with major concerns that if it could not secure an IMF deal, it may have ended up defaulting later this year. This deal should avoid that scenario. This new money should carry the country through to a long-awaited general election expected to happen in the autumn and will give some short-term economic clarity, but does not solve Pakistan's long-term, economically precarious position.
Caroline Davies. Countries in the European Union say they'll reduce their dependency on China and look for alternative trade opportunities. The policy, known as de-risking, was agreed at a summit of EU leaders in Brussels, where our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, was also attending. My colleague, Nick Miles, asked him first to explain exactly what de-risking is.
You do hear a lot of rather incomprehensible jargon at summits like this. De-risking, though, is not too bad. Really, this goes back to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. What happened that the Western European countries, European Union countries, complained, huffed and puffed, but they realised they were rather dependent on Russia for oil and gas, and that limited their room for manoeuvre. It gave the Kremlin a rather lot of ability to exert economic pressure. So they've decided they're not going to make the same mistake with China. The thing is, of course, that European Union countries and others import vast amounts of goods from China, many of them essential for running a modern economy, hence the commitment to de-risk, to find alternative sources of these imports, alternative supply chains, not to be dependent on China, because China could itself cause military problems if, most obviously, it was to invade Taiwan. They don't want to be in that position where China can say, well, you can't do very much, or we'll stop sending you what you need to make, whether it's smartphones, TVs, or items essential for your infrastructure.
So, Paul, they've found agreement, but did all the countries in the EU sign up to this?
Well, they did all agree to the final statement, but that was partly just by making the final statement a little vague, because there is some diversity here. You have countries in Eastern Europe, like Lithuania, which have been very critical of China. They're particularly angry that China continues to be an ally of Russia, that it hasn't condemned the invasion of Ukraine. They want a fairly severe economic decoupling from China. Then you have countries like France and Germany, which want to keep the relationship closer. This, of course, may be something to do with the fact that they not only buy things from China, France and Germany export a lot of their goods to China. So what they've done, they've issued a statement which speaks a little vaguely. It says we will reduce critical dependence and vulnerabilities, including in supply chains. And then it says where necessary and appropriate. So that does allow different countries to take a vaguely different approach. But I should say they have won unanimity, all are signed up to the general attitude of de-risking.
Paul, obviously China disagrees with their assessment. So what has this... what has China had to say about this?
Well, they haven't reacted to the news today yet, but this wasn't unexpected, so we know what they think. Last week, China dispatched its Prime Minister Li Qiang to France on a sort of attempt to fend this off, and he gave a speech where he criticised de-risking. He said it was good for countries to be dependent on each other, it created bonds. He said in this rather Chinese phrase, he said, "I've heard disharmonious voices about China." That may sound like an odd phrase, the kind of thing you'd expect perhaps a disgruntled choir master to say, disharmonious voices. But in the Chinese traditional Confucian outlook, harmony is what you strive for. And when China says they're hearing disharmonious voices, they mean bad for international relations, bad for relations between China and the rest of the world. But it clearly doesn't seem to worry them, because the European Union, because they've gone ahead and issued this statement today.
Paul Moss. Still to come in this podcast, Cambodia's long-term leader Hun Sen has threatened to block access to Facebook in his country. And the Happy Pod is out on Saturday. Here's my colleague, Jackie Leonard.
Hello. Yes, in this week's edition, some good news for thousands of endangered Tok Makak monkeys after Sri Lanka decided not to allow their capture and export to China. We'll hear about the largest school meals programme in Africa, due to begin shortly in Kenya, fulfilling a dream and playing Glastonbury, aged just 16. And you might be able to help with this one, the Australian man who was born in a taxi and who's trying to find the driver. All in the Happy Pod, uploaded on Saturday, July the 1st.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A BBC investigation has found TikTok is not removing videos that deny the existence of man-made climate change, despite a promise in April that it would do so. Marco Silva has the story.
These days, there's one story that one way or another seems to be never far from the headlines.
Devastating scenes that have become all too familiar. Several parts of Wales have been hit by flooding.
The evidence of climate change and the threat it poses to the planet is overwhelming. But if you look at TikTok, you might get a different impression.
Wake up, guys. Global warming isn't real.
There is no climate change in the manner in which they speak.
But some are trying to counter the denial and misinformation on the platform.
What's up, guys? Rosh here, and welcome to All About Climate, a channel dedicated to...
Rosh is a British TikTok creator who gets thousands of views for his videos debunking viral climate myths that are spreading online. He's a PhD student with a master's in climate change, and he says there's no shortage of misleading videos on TikTok for him to fact-check.
Anyone can post anything, and it has the potential to reach thousands or even millions of views, basically. Bad arguments can spread really fast.
In April this year, TikTok announced a new policy to crack down on climate misinformation. It said it would remove content that undermines the well-established scientific consensus on climate change. Like this.
Three facts why climate change is not man-made. Fact 1, CO2 stays in the atmosphere only for 2 years.
But how well is the new policy working? Well, to test this out, we identified 365 videos that broke the rules, either because they denied climate change is real or that humans are causing it.
The banks of this world know it's not going to happen.
We reported all these videos to TikTok under the category of harmful misinformation, which is available to any user on the app. But when we checked back, at least 24 hours later, almost 95% of them were still online. TikTok declined my request for an interview, but in a statement, the company says...
We work to empower informed climate discussions on TikTok, and we prohibit harmful misinformation that denies the existence of climate change.
The company also says it's working with fact-checkers in directing users who search for climate content to authoritative information. When we sent TikTok links to all the videos we reported, they took most of them down. And the ones that are still online? Well, for the most part, TikTok says they're no longer being recommended to users. The company also suspended 65 accounts that had been posting wrong information about climate change.
That report by Marco Silva. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has spoken for the first time since Wagner's failed mutiny last week. The mercenary group marched towards Russia and many saw it as a sign of weakness in the Kremlin. But in a news conference, the minister tried to give the impression that Russia has not been rattled and that any doubts were other leaders' problems.
We are not obliged to anyone to explain these. We act transparently, and the president has spoken to all the political forces in the country about it. If you have any doubts about that in the West, that's your problem. But we have very serious doubts about the adequacy of many Western leaders.
Since the failed revolt, the BBC has learned that the Wagner Group is still recruiting fighters across Russia. We asked our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, how she'd managed to find this out.
By calling Wagner recruitment centres across Russia. There's a long list of them on the Wagner website. It's still up. The website is still working. They're recruitment centres that are based in fight clubs, so anything from judo to mixed martial art clubs or boxing centres across Russia. So we started calling them. And as we did, we found that all of the people we spoke to said yes, they were still recruiting, that it was business as usual. Nothing had changed. Now, if people asked us directly who we were, we said we were inquiring for a brother who was interested in signing up. So perhaps that's why these recruitment centres are a bit more open with us. And they said that they confirmed that they were actually signing contracts with the Wagner Group itself and not with the Defence Ministry. Now, that's important because, of course, it was an order, essentially, for Wagner as a group, independent group, to disband and for fighters to join the Defence Ministry that was at the root of this really fierce feud that had been bubbling up for months in Russia and then exploded into last weekend's armed mutiny. But it is extraordinary, I have to say, that almost a week later, in a country where organisations, peaceful political opposition organisations have been banned and their leaders put in prison and they have been declared extremists, the group that actually staged an armed uprising is still operating in the country and is still recruiting fighters.
Sarah Rainsford. Cambodia's Prime Minister Hun Sen has threatened to block Facebook from operating in his country. His warning comes a day after the social media giant removed a video in which he called for violence against his opponents. Rupert Wingfield-Hayes reports.
This showdown between Facebook and Cambodia's long-serving authoritarian ruler has been brewing for months. In January, Hun Sen's party used Facebook to live stream a speech in which he said his opponents should either be prosecuted or beaten up. That prompted complaints to Facebook, saying Hun Sen's Facebook and Instagram accounts should be suspended for at least 6 months. Hours later, the Cambodian leader announced he had decided to stop using the platform and deleted his account. The decision by Facebook's oversight board has been welcomed by human rights groups.
Rupert Wingfield-Hayes. Lithium has become one of the must-have modern metals, a key part of batteries for a world in which cars are increasingly powered by electricity rather than fossil fuels. And that's why a new agreement by Bolivia with a Chinese and a Russian company to extract lithium from the country's salt flats has attracted attention. More than two-thirds of the world's known reserves are found in the salt flats of Bolivia, Argentina and Chile, known as the Lithium Triangle. Fia Riofrancos is Associate Professor of Political Science at Providence College and an expert on resource extraction in Latin America. My colleague Roger Hearing asked her if this deal was significant.
I think it is a big development for a couple of reasons. One is that the Bolivian government for several years now has been trying to develop its lithium reserves. This project actually started under Evo Morales, of Bolivia, right, and continues today. So there have been various frustrated attempts with trying to identify the kind of foreign partner for joint venture to develop lithium resources into a kind of more full-fledged lithium production and also more potentially kind of down the supply chain as well. So significant for Bolivia, let's put it that way. It's also, I think, significant for a couple of other reasons. I mean, there have been a lot of concerns about supplies of lithium, like will there be enough for the electric vehicle revolution, right? And this potentially, if it goes according to plan, which we don't know, but if it does, brings more supply online, you know, so that's another kind of reason it might be significant. And then a third has to do with geopolitics or geoeconomics, maybe better put, which is that, you know, I think it's not a coincidence per se that Chinese and Russian companies, two Chinese companies and one Russian company, have been the ones to win the tenders for these projects.
Well,
right?
I was going to pick up on that point specifically, if I may, because it is interesting that this is happening, that this geopolitics of it. Does that mean that this was a resource that will perhaps now not be directed towards the West, will be directed in a different direction? And will that cause some concern, I suppose, in the US and Europe?
Well, it's an interesting question. I would almost turn that on its head because some of that or a lot of that depends on the West, meaning, you know, why would it be per se that lithium that enters into a Chinese manufactured battery battery manufactured in China couldn't enter into Western battery supply? You know, part of the reason for that is that in the U.S., there are various policy decisions that limit, you know, whether or not you can get an EV rebate, where the minerals are sourced from, and actually exclude China from, you know, Chinese sourcing from some of those consumer rebates and manufacturer tax credits. So it might be, I guess, in answer to your question, that this Bolivian supply sort of doesn't end up in a U.S. supply chain, so to speak. But some of that has to do with decisions that the U.S. government has made to intentionally try to exclude or disincentivize Chinese supplies from the U.S. supply chain.
Yeah, now, Thea, one of the other interesting aspects of this is always the case when there's resource extraction anywhere in the world is what will the Bolivians get from it? Particularly, what will the Bolivian people, as opposed to necessarily the government, get out of it?
Well, I think that remains a big question. And I will note that the last time that there was a signed contract with a German company for a similar project to develop these resources, it was subsequently canceled by the Morales government because of local protest around the distribution of economic revenues, right? Locals felt that they were not going to get enough of the economic pie based on the contract design. So that, I think, will be a real test for the current government if they can design a contract that creates, you know, local economic benefits, economic revenues, and also jobs for local people.
But also, of course, there is the environmental impact of this kind of thing. These are salt flats, when particularly, I would have thought, a kind of vulnerable environment to have this done to them. Is that an issue?
That is absolutely an issue. And we know that from the neighboring countries of Argentina and Chile, where there's been much more accelerated and extensive lithium development, lithium mining, than there has been in Bolivia. Argentina and Chile are two of the top global producers, right? So we know at this point that there are impacts on the water system, on biodiversity, and that also that this can cause protest. In fact, right now in Argentina, there are major protests around lithium, partly for environmental reasons, for social reasons, and there's been a lot of repression of that protest, right? And so it would be concerning if we see similar impacts unfold in Bolivia as well.
And how will Argentina and Chile regard what's going on in Bolivia? Are they just welcome them to the party, or is it a competition?
It is an interesting question because, you know, there could be a competitive element, but there's also been increasing coordination among these governments, right? I don't know if you've sort of read the news about a so-called lithium OPEC, but these governments, along with the Mexican government, have been in conversation. Their ministers of energy and of mining have been in conversation with one another to try to coordinate their sectors to kind of prevent that race to the bottom dynamic. And so that's still a kind of open question, but it is interesting that they're attempting some level of collaboration.
Professor Thea Riofrancos, it's a never-before-seen view of our galaxy. Using an observatory buried beneath the Antarctic ice, astronomers have detected ghost particles emitted from the Milky Way, which helps them to better understand what's happening in our home star system. Our science correspondent, Victoria Gill, explains.
Neutrinos, or ghost particles as they're known, are made when cosmic rays that are rattling around space at near light speed smash into other matter. Astronomers say understanding where they come from is key to understanding the dynamics that shape the Milky Way. But these short-lived particles are very difficult to detect, so scientists and engineers created an observatory that turned a cubic kilometre of Antarctic ice into a neutrino finder. The ice cube detector, as it's called, is made of thousands of sensors on long cables buried under the South Pole. Whenever a neutrino interacts with one of the billions of ice molecules, it captures that interaction and works out where that neutrino came from. The detectors produced the first evidence of these ghost particles in our home galaxy, which the researchers say gives them an entirely new window on what's happening in the Milky Way.
Victoria Gill. We're launching a new Match of the Day podcast, and Nick Miles heard more about it.
There's a new Match of the Day podcast out now, Match of the Day Africa Top 10. Former Manchester City midfielder Yaya Toure and former Norwich and Nigeria striker Efan Ekoku debate all things African football with the best goal scorers to the continent's biggest World Cup moments. With Gabriel Zakwani there to ask the tough questions. Gabriel told me what we might expect.
Debate, interesting conversations, and also reminiscing of players that maybe we've forgotten about in the past. And it's been important that African players get recognised, because I don't think they get recognised as much as they should, but we're experts in that field. And I think it's just important for people to really see what we think about former African players and current African players.
And this isn't the ruminations of any old people, it are top panellists.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great panel, really. You've got Yaya Toure, who's arguably one of the Premier League's best ever players. And you have Efan Ekoku, who has played for Nigeria at a high level in the Premier League as well, and played in AFCON, won AFCON. So there's a lot. There's a lot there. And obviously, I don't want to toot my own trumpet, but I've played at three African Cup of Nations. But yeah, it's a good panel to have. So three people who really know what they're talking about.
Well, let's have a taste now of what you might hear if you listen into that podcast.
Who have you got in number two, Effa?
I have his countryman now. I have his countryman, Monsieur Drogba. Mm-hmm. I mean, these two, I think, are arguably the most important big-time goal scorers, mm-hmm. not just in African football, in world football,
in the last football,
20
yeah.
years, along with Messi and Ronaldo, maybe that level a bit more.
There's a new episode available every Monday. The first episode on the top 10 African Premier League players is out on July the 3rd. Search Match of the Day Africa Top 10 wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Nick Miles. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Charlotta Tozimka, the producer was Beth Timmins, and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.